Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
You are back in the House of Mystery, and I'm Al Warren, of course, and side saddle, we've got Mike Brown. How are you doing, Mike?
Yeah, I'm like the queen with my little wave there.
yeah, you're going to be on Oprah this weekend, I hear.
Sure, yeah.
Wow, here we go. So today we've got a great writer. He's got a lot of experience. His book, The Witches in West Memphis, was really an eye-opener and, I think, great book. George Jarrett, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So, George, let's talk about you first. How did it all start for you? How did you get into true crime and writing and just all of this stuff you do?
You know, it was kind of a circuitous route for me. I went to college. My plan was to be a lawyer. I was going to go to law school, and then I did the whole, the go to Europe for a month thing after I graduated, got my 4-year degree. And I, at the time I was married, I told my wife, I said, hey, I think I'm going to take a year off from law school and I need to get a job. And journalism had always fascinated me from the time I was a kid. I just, when I was in high school, I was the editor of the school newspaper. I love to read newspapers. I look like I was a younger guy at the time, but I'd be like an old man sitting in a restaurant reading a newspaper. So I just loved journalism. So I went to a local newspaper, talked to the editor, a great guy. I consider him one of my mentors. He told me that I did a writing test for him. He says, you can write. You need to clean some of this stuff up. He goes, if you want to be a lawyer, why don't I hire you? You can go cover cops and courts. And you can, get a feel for the courtroom, learn how judges interact with attorneys, how they make arguments, all the things. So it just sounded like a great tutorial heading into law school. So I got a job. I started writing stories. Funny thing is I worked at a small newspaper, so I got to cover everything. I covered government, politics, business, education. And then about 7 months into my first job, there was a woman vanished, a college student. Her name was Rebecca Gould. And a week later, they found her body. I was out there when they found her. And I was actually the one that ended up telling her father, who's a prominent dentist, that they had found her body. And so for 16 years, her case was unsolved. And then actually just a couple of months ago, finally, they arrested a guy in Eugene, Oregon. He actually was living in the Philippines. I guess he owned a plantation there. But he was the first cousin of this girl's sort of boyfriend at the time. And he has been charged with capital murder. So for 16, 17 years, I had written about that case, followed it, And so that's kind of how I got my start. That case in recent years has gotten very, I want to say nationally known. Dr. Oz did about an hour show on it a couple of years ago. And then the Helen Gone podcast with Catherine Townsend from the Discovery Channel, she had put together an 8-part podcast on that case. And I helped her with that. So that's kind of how I got my start.
Well, it's interesting, but journalism's changed a lot. And you're in that period where all the change seems to be happening quite rapidly. How do you feel about doing reporting now as compared to just when you started?
It's tough because, you know, like I hear there's a term out there called fake news, and it really irritates me to no end. Because basically, when you hear the term fake news by a lot of people, what that means is if you report on something they don't like, they think it's fake, and that's wrong. There's not a human being on this planet that doesn't have biases to some degree in some form. But, you know, most of the journalists I've worked with through the years, I know journalists all over the country. Well, I know journalists all over the world. And, you know, I guess that's probably the hardest thing for journalists now is that you go out, you try to honestly cover something, and then there's a percentage of the population that doesn't like what you're covering. So then it's fake. And, you know, it's like I told somebody, a real good friend of mine, you know, he was mad about journalists and some of the stuff that was being covered in the political arena recently. And I said, hey, you have an option here. Go do it for yourself. If you think you can do a better job, if you think you can be more accurate, hey, there are doors open. Go run through those doors and you can do the same job. So I think that's probably the toughest thing is just because being a journalist just in general is a really hard job that you don't get paid a lot for. You know, I told a bunch of college students one time, I said, you know, as a journalist, I have to be an expert in all these different areas. I have to be a criminologist. I have to understand how, I write a lot about like crops, commodities. So I have to know a lot about soybeans on a given day. You know, a couple of days ago, I was writing stuff with the legislature here in the state I live in. So, you know, I'm sitting there going through bills and stuff like that, spending hours and hours doing the research. So kind of when you're done at the end of that process, you don't want to hear that maybe what you're reporting is fake when you know to the best of your knowledge and abilities, it's not.
Yeah, but that seems to be the climate because even I get messages and emails all the time saying I work for the government or I'm whatever, you know, you get accused of things. So that really makes the job a lot more difficult, don't you think? Because as soon as you write something, there's an attack towards you without even really, it's really not about what you wrote. It's just more about the subject and whose side you're on, they might think, or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like they expect you to take a side, and it's like, I don't have any sides. I mean, you know, going back to politics, you know, I've met a lot of Republicans I like, a lot of Democrats I like. I've met a lot of Republicans I can't stand. I've met a lot of Democrats I can't stand. You know, you can go back and look at my reporting record through the years. You know, I've gone after Republicans and Democrats with the same litmus test. If you do something that you're not supposed to do, if you do something illegal, if you do something immoral or wrong or something, if you go out and tell your constituency that you're going to support some initiative and then you don't support it or you are actually against it, when the reality of it is when you actually go in and vote and do your job and you're actually against it, then I report on it. And I have equally made both sides of the aisle very, very angry at me, which means I did the right. That means I'm doing my job.
Yeah. No, for sure. For sure. But when you say, you know, to someone, oh, well, you don't think I'm doing a good job, you go out and do it. But a lot of people think that they can do it better by just sitting at home and being on the internet. And there's so much stuff out there, we'll say, that's just not very legitimate.
Yeah, I mean, I try to tell people all the time, you know, hey, if you're watching YouTube and somebody puts on a lab coat, they're probably not a scientist or a doctor, so don't listen to them. You know, I mean, well, I saw it on YouTube; it must be real. I saw it on Facebook. Like, no, you didn't see it, or you did see it, but it's not real. You know, so like, I wrote about, you know, I'll give you for instance, I write a lot about COVID-19. And the numbers. And I hear all the time people are like, oh, I don't believe these numbers. And I'm like, well, we've only been calculating these numbers with this specific way of calculating them for 100 years. Since 1918, when the Spanish flu, you know, killed millions of people all over the world. I mean, a worldwide pandemic is something that you can expect. I mean, most people don't know this in this country, but far more people have died from viruses, you know, smallpox, polio, all these other things, than have ever died in war. So the US, our government, basically, if you boiled it down to two primary functions through the 240 some odd years of history we've had this country, the two major things that this country has dealt with through the years, actually three, you know, economic depressions and recessions, wars, and pandemics, viruses, you know, diseases that impact the entire population. So this should be expected. Those numbers are real. They're going to get worse. I told a friend of mine yesterday at the gym, he's like, I just don't believe 500,000 people have died from this disease. I said, you're totally right. 500,000 people haven't. It's a whole lot more. Yeah. Because that's what we always find out when they go in and do the autopsy of the event, is that they find that many more people died from it. It started much earlier. That's what they're going to find, because that's what they found in every other instance.
Yeah. Well, I heard it's not real.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I have one of my best friends, he has an older brother who's just a couple years older than me. My friend was a very, you know, he doesn't believe in it. He says, I don't think that this is real. His own brother died from it.
Yeah.
And I've got the text messages from his brother, or not, as he was texting me as his brother was dying in the hospital. And I'm like, this is real. I mean, I understand that there's a whole lot of people who may not get very violently ill or die from this, but there's a lot of people. I mean, people don't understand. Right now, we've lost 500,000 people to this disease. That impacts the economy. I mean, people don't understand. When you take 500,000 people out of a population, that has severe impacts for everyone involved. It's not just the health risk involved. There's a lot of things and these things will always play out. And all you have to do is pick up a history book. I read a book called Pandemic 1918 by Catherine Arnold. Actually, ironically enough, I was reading that book at the end of February because I started hearing a little bit about COVID in China. And so I was like, you know, this would be a good time to read that book. Everything in that book, I told everybody exactly what would happen, the masking, the social distancing, because that's what they did 100 years ago. Before they could even identify a virus under a microscope, scientists still knew how viruses worked.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's really sad to see people go through that. I mean, I lost a co-host to Alex Jones because he was kind of going, people can be very smart and still jump into this rabbit hole and still follow it through and really believe it.
You know, and I don't want to compare these two things, but there is a mentality, like, people don't realize this, like in Nazi Germany, what the Nazis did when they appointed like commanders to their like Einsatzgruppen groups that would go through the through Russia, Poland, places like that, and they would go in and they would exterminate these Jewish populations in these little villages and towns. Well, they had what they called an Einsatzgruppen, which was these four groups. And they were commanded by guys who had PhDs. And what it is they would go in and they would indoctrinate the guys with the PhDs. And then these guys, if you have a PhD, you obviously have a very articulate, you're bright, you have an articulate mind. So they were able to talk to their soldiers and make them believe that even though these horrible atrocities they were committing were right. And so the Nazis were very good at finding highly educated people to run these groups. And so, you know, I'm always afraid here in this country. I know some of the smartest people I know. They will say things to me that are absolutely absurd.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, it's just the times, and I hope it swings back. But you know, and what caught me was, you know, it's funny. We're not really, but we were going to do a week series on the West Memphis Three. And I was scheduling people to come on. And I couldn't believe the vicious attacks that these people, and I joined a couple of groups on Facebook just to kind of get the feel, and I had some of these people lined up, and I was getting it together, but I couldn't believe how vicious people were with each other about this case. Geez, it must have been real hard for you. You must have been accused of being a Satan worshiper or all sorts of things.
Literally the exact words. I mean, I would get emails, phone calls, people who, You know, and I had, and there's an interesting part of the West Memphis 3 case. I didn't start writing about it until 2008. And what happened was, is they had what they call post-conviction hearings. And so literally there were hundreds of hours of post-conviction hearings in Jonesboro, Arkansas. Well, the newspaper I worked at the time was just down the street. It was an Associated Press newspaper. And so I would cover all these hearings. The hearings lasted probably three times as long as the actual trials, both trials for the guys convicted. You know, and I tell people all the time, the first time I walked into a courtroom, it was in April of 2008. I was there to cover a 20-minute hearing. What had happened is we had an EF4 tornado had come through, had ransacked a big part of Arkansas. It was one of the longest continuous track tornadoes ever recorded. It was an EF4. 122 miles it had tracked. And so you guys had mentioned Oprah earlier. Well, there was a rumor going around that she was going to come. There was many towns impacted. Several people had died, that she was going to come and do like one of her community giveaways. And it was between one town in Arkansas that this tornado hit and another town, I think in Kentucky. And so I told my boss at the time, I'm like, hey, if Oprah shows up, I got to be there. You know, you can't not be there for that. So, well, coincidentally, I will just divulge this to you, and I'm sure this will be a shock to my former editor. My daughter had a softball game in the same town that day. So I went there to cover that. Well, as I'm sitting there, she texts me and says, hey, can you cover West Memphis 3 in the morning? And I'm like, sure, because they were going to have a hearing. Well, I looked at a friend of mine. I said, what's the West Memphis 3? And him and I started talking, and I'm like, oh, yeah, they did a documentary about it back like in 1996. And I had seen the documentary, so I kind of remembered it. So I went to this 20-minute hearing. I met Dennis Reardon. He was Barry Bonds' attorney in this Balco steroids case. Well, he was representing Damian Echols pro bono at this point. And he was flying from San Francisco for all the hearings. Super nice guy. Talked to him for a little bit, but then the judge, we get into the courtroom. He gags everybody, says, I don't want to see this in the newspapers, blah, blah, blah. So they gagged gag orders put in place. And at that point, I thought, okay, well, this will be the end of this. We had a reporter who had been covering the West Memphis 3 from the day the bodies were found on the ditch bank. Well, I went on a trip to Florida early in the summer, and I get a call from my boss again telling me that that reporter had been fired. And because I had covered this one hearing in a whole newsroom full of reporters and editors and everything else, I suddenly became an expert on the West Memphis 3. So when I get back off vacation, they were going to bring in some of the most high-powered forensic pathologists in the world to testify about the evidence in the case. So I'm sure you guys are familiar with Dr. Warner Spitz.
Right.
He came and he testified for several days, and he just absolutely chewed up and spit out the prosecution's case. And I will say this, you know, the first time I walked into the courtroom, the first time I saw Jason Baldwin, I thought, okay, there's a very heinous child killer right there. You know, I had no reason to believe that the prosecution and the police had gotten this case so wrong. And so Dr. Spitz starts testifying around this time. It's amazing. Back during that time, people would actually take vacation from around the world and come to Jonesboro, Arkansas to listen to these trials or these post-conviction hearings. And so there was an attorney from Philadelphia, him and his girlfriend. They were there for the whole week when Dr. Spitz was testifying and some of these other guys, Dr. Michael Bodden. And I was sitting out in the hallway with his girlfriend, and she's talking to me. She's like, so do you think these guys did it? And I said, yeah. I said, you know, the prosecutor couldn't be this far off. Could the police really be this far off? And so she said, just tell me what is the most compelling piece of information that leads you to believe that these three did it. And I said, okay, well, I didn't have anything. So I just blurted out confession, you know, Jesse Miss Kelly Jr.'s confession. Right. And she said to me, she said, have you ever read it? And I said, no, I have not. And she said, well, go read it and tell me what you think. So I went back to my office that night. I pulled out his confession. I threw it up on the desk. I started reading through it. It was laughable. He got nothing right. I mean, this is what I know. I've covered, you know, I don't know how many murders now, probably a dozen, two dozen. I can't even keep track of all of them. And one thing I know about authentic confessions now is that an authentic confession will tell you things about the crime scene or the crime that you didn't know before, number one. So, and then there's an explanation as to why the lamp is knocked over here and why there's blood splatter on this window, why this certain object has been removed from the house and all these other details. And his confession did none of that. In fact, his confession was wrong. He said that the boys were kidnapped in the morning. They were not kidnapped in the morning. He said they were on their way to school when they got them. That's not true. He said they were tied with ropes around their arms and ankles. Not true. They were tied with their shoelaces. When asked to describe the place where the bodies were dumped, he could not do it. He tried to draw a diagram of what it looked like. He got everything wrong. There was nothing that he got right. So they take this confession, quote unquote, to a magistrate, and the magistrate even tells him, this will never work. I mean, this doesn't match anything in the case. So then they magically go back the same day. They turn the recorder back on, and magically he gets some of those details right to a degree. And then that's when the arrest warrants are issued. So as I'm listening to these forensic experts testify, it was becoming plainly and clearly obvious to me that there were major holes in this case. For instance, they said that Jason Baldwin took this big Rambo-style knife, and it was in the courtroom, and that he took it and that he emasculated Christopher Byers. Well, here's the problem, and I don't mean to be too graphic, but, you know, his genitals were skinned. They were not cut off, if that makes sense. So if you've ever seen, and they call it a Rambo-style knife, I'm sure you guys have seen it.
Oh, I have one.
Yeah, you have one. Okay, so there you go, right? So, and I, at the time, and this is ironic, my son was probably around 8, 9 years old when this was going on in the courtroom. He might have been 10. But I'm sitting there looking at that knife, and I know I know the anatomy of an 8 to 9 year old boy.
Right.
And I'm sitting there going, you're telling me that you took that knife and you surgically removed the skin from his genitals and his penis. And then you took that same knife and you scraped his skin. Because here's the thing. I don't know if you guys are aware of this or not, but among all three of those boys' bodies, did you know that there was not one bone piercing injury?
No, actually, I don't.
Not one knife thrust. So you have this knife, you're raping and torturing these kids, and you have this 9-inch long knife, and there's not one wound on any of the bodies, a flesh wound where you stabbed them with the knife.
Mm.
Not buying it.
Yeah. Well, why was there, what do you think it was that drove the police to hold on to this so hard and the prosecutor?
Well, you know, there was a term, satanic panic. I know you guys have heard that many times.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is what I tried to describe about West Memphis, and I'm not trying to besmirch anybody. But basically in North America, there are, you know, we've got a major highway that runs from Canada down to Mexico, 55. And then actually, if you really want to look at it, it runs all the way to the Antarctica. You know, it runs all the way down through South America, too. And then you've got Interstate 40 that runs from the West Coast to the East Coast. There is one place on the map where these two major highways intersect, and it's West Memphis, Arkansas. And why that's important is that all goods that are moved by truck are moved north, south, east, west. And that includes, you know, furniture, groceries, whatever. Well, that also includes drugs, because drugs are moved on trucks for the most part. So if you're a drug kingpin, there's certain places on the map that you kind of want to have some control. And West Memphis, Arkansas would be one of those places. And they've had a lot of trouble over there. You know, they'll bust a truck. They'll find, you know, cash and drugs and all sorts of stuff in there. And then magically the cash and the drugs just vanished. They don't know where it went. And so the FBI's had to do, you know, several investigations over there. So the police department there, when this whole thing went down, they didn't want a bunch of other agencies coming in and starting an investigating. You know what I mean? So they wanted to keep this insular. They didn't let the state police in. They didn't ask for the FBI to help them. And so they developed a theory pretty quickly that it was satan, that somehow this was an occult killing. One of the guys, a guy named Steve Jones, who was present when the bodies were found, he was a social worker who had worked with Damien Eccles. He made the comment. He said, I guarantee you Damien Eccles had something to do with this. Now, it's very important to recognize what he said there, because here's the thing. If I commit a crime, let's say I kill someone, well, there's only a couple of ways you can immediately prove I did it, right? If I confess, I go to the police station and say, I killed so-and-so and this is how I did it. Okay, then I'm a prime suspect. Let's say three people see me do it, and they go to the police station and say, hey, George killed so-and-so, and this is how we did it. Okay, then I'm immediately a suspect. Or let's say the police come to the crime scene, and they see a cacophony of evidence that points towards me. My driver's license is there for some reason. It's my gun. People saw my truck or car or whatever there at this scene. Okay, so if you have one of those three instances, then you would hone in on me pretty quickly. Now, if you don't have that, then you have to do police work. You have to collect evidence. You got to talk to witnesses. That's a process, and it takes time. Within 24 hours of these three bodies being found, Damien Echols had already been interviewed. And none of those first three scenarios were in play when he was interviewed. So that tells you from the beginning that the police were honing in on him, and they were trying to cater their – they weren't letting the evidence take them to the place. They were trying to put Echols in the place, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I just – so why did so many of them, and still to this day, believe that it was some sort of satanic worship?
You know, it's kind of one of those things, you know, when you buy into an argument, any phase of life for any level, when you've bought into an argument about something, you just can't let it go. I mean, no matter the level of evidence that's presented to you, no matter, you know, what was it? I'm probably going to screw this up. What's that old Mark Twain saying? You know, it's easier to tell somebody a lie than convince them of the truth. Yeah. You know, so they got convinced about a lie, which it was a total and 100% lie. Those boys were not sacrificing in a satanic or occult ceremony. And so they believed it. You know, here's the thing. We have a vast swath of our population who loves the macabre. You know, they're into true crime. They're into satanic, you know, like not into it, but I mean, like studying it, like reading about it. And so there's just a lot of people who are into it. They bought into this false premise. And the problem is, and I told Damien Echols this when I interviewed him when he was on death row. I said, you know, what the problem is for them now is that science has really advanced, you know, in the last 15, 20 years. And so now some of these false, these arguments are just proving to be false, you know, and it's being proved out by just good science. And so, I would say this. I don't think – I would say it's probably 75-25 now, people who know about the West Memphis case. I think 75% of the people who know about it now don't believe these guys had anything to do with it. But there's still that very vocal 25%, and I hear from them every now and then. I mean, they tell me I'm a Satan worshiper, that I'm Lucifer, that I'm on Damien Echols' payroll. I'm like, I guess I need to give him a call and tell him he needs to start sending some checks my way because I haven't seen any yet.
Yeah, they're getting lost in the mail, I guess.
Yeah, you know, that's a thing right now, right? The mail.
Yeah. Well, you know, because I think, geez, you know, three of the people I'd lined up, like even William Ramsey, there's some of these people, and they're really big into the Aleister Crowley thing and
yep.
That, oh, you know, anybody that had anything good to say about Damien Echols or any of them, they would look for things. Oh, look at, he's holding his fingers just this way, in this circular way. He must be part of the Aleister.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
The Crawley thing. And what was that band? There was a rock band. Was it Stone Temple Pilots or somebody that was...
No, Metallica was a big time... supporter of the West Memphis Three.
Yeah, and so they just link everybody to it, and it just gets a little bit too crazy. How did you feel about Damian Eccles when you actually talked with him?
You know, it was interesting. He wrote me a letter it was in the spring of 2010. Walked in one day, saw it sitting there. His penmanship was great. I mean, he very neatly written letter. And you know, when I went down there, it was in June of 2010. I actually spent some time with his wife, Lori, interviewed her. I actually went out and ate dinner with her one night. I told her, I said, you know, everybody on the planet thinks you're like,
oh my,
crazy. You know that, right? I mean, and she laughed, you know, and she's like, oh yeah, because she's this highly educated, affluent woman who married a guy who's sitting on Arkansas's death row, you know, for the heinous murder of three children. And so I went down there, a photographer and I, we went and interviewed him. The interview was supposed to last, I think, 45 minutes. We ended up talking for about 4 hours. Damian is intelligent. He was an intelligent guy, very articulate, very forthcoming, very honest. He knew the mistakes he had made, you know, as far as, you know, lampooning to the families of the victims. You know, he knew that was a horrible mistake, but he was a kid. Or a teenager, 18 years old or whatever. You know, the thing I always tell people, you know, we think about the West Memphis Three as like a unit. But in actuality, there are three different people. And they're three different people from a legal perspective as well. And one thing that Damian told me when I was there is he wanted every bit of evidence DNA tested. He goes, test it all. And that was interesting to me because... And I know that an attorney had to talk to him. I know he'll never admit it, and an attorney will never say it. But an attorney had to pull him into a room at some point when this whole process is going on and had to have said to him, okay, listen, if they test DNA test for everything and they don't find your DNA, you're fine. They don't find Jason's DNA, you're fine. But what if just by happenstance they found Jesse's DNA? Now, that doesn't convict you in a court of law, but you know where it will convict you? In the court of public opinion. And what they had done is they had raised so much awareness and raised so much money to get themselves out that literally if they had found, you know, DNA from another suspect among the three, then it would convict the other two just because we assume they're, you know, like one unit. So they took a risk. I mean, it was a very strategic risk, and they never faltered one time. Every time there was a test available, they said, test it all, do all the testing.
Yeah, pretty interesting. Yeah, who do you think did it, or do you? do you have like an opinion? There's a few other people that, you know, have come up and they sort of suggest it in some of the documentaries. What's your thoughts?
Yeah. You know, of course, the most famous documentary about this case, Paradise Lost, with Joe Berlinger and Bruce Sinofsky.
Right.
And they I knew Bruce before he passed away, and I still know Joe. In fact, I saw him a couple of years ago. I used to spend a lot of time with those guys when they were putting together, especially the third Paradise Lost 3. They were in town a lot, and used to talk to them about this case a lot. You know, of course, they pointed the finger at Terry Hobbs, the stepfather. And I've interviewed Terry probably three times. And, you know, I told him one time when I was talking to him, I said, hey, he said, do you think I had something to do with it? And I said, I'm a journalist. I'm a writer. It's not my place to convict anybody for anything. I said, but I will say this. Your DNA was found on one of the victims. Your alibi witness says there's no way you guys were together when the boys disappeared. And I've interviewed him. He told me to my face, we were not together when these boys disappeared. Well, automatically, that means that he's telling a story. His alibi witness is telling a competing story. Terry's DNA is found on one of the victims, and he admits it is probably his DNA. It was a hair that was found on Michael Moore. And then, of course, there's another piece of DNA evidence found at the crime scene. It's a hair from David Jacoby. And so you have a stepdad, the guy that he was with, just previous. Now, we do know that he was with David Jacoby in the hour before the boys disappeared. That has been verified. So you've got a competing story. You've got DNA evidence at the scene. And then you've got three women. See, Terry's whole story is that he came home from work that day and never saw Stevie, never saw Christopher, never saw Michael, never saw the three boys. And that he, you know, went out and started looking for him at some point. Well, the problem is that we have affidavits from three women who are on their way to church, you know, a woman named Jamie Clark Ballard and her sister and her mother, who saw the boys come through their backyard around 6:30 that night. And they told the boys that some family members were out looking for them. And Christopher told Jamie, he said, you can't tell me what to do. You're not my boss. And she said, well, your brother, because she was in the same grade as his older brother, Ryan. She says, well, Ryan's looking for you. You need to go home. Well, right about the time as they're pulling out and driving up the street, a guy who matches Terry Hobbs' description is motioning for the boys to come inside the house.
Hmm. Wow. It's a pretty... do you think it ever really be solved, this case?
Probably. I'll say this. If you would have asked me the day before the guys got released, if they'd ever get released, I would have told you no. If you would have asked me on November 6th, of 2020, if Rebecca Gould's murder case, which had been unsolved for going on 17 years, if it would get solved, I would say probably not. So I'll say this, some other shoe would have to drop, like there would have to be a full, real confession from somebody, more than likely. But that's probably, at this point, you know, it's so ironic to cover a case like this. Because now you're getting to the point in life where literally some of these characters and people who are involved in this case, they're literally starting to pass away. You know, John Mark Byers was killed in a car wreck last year. And so he's gone now. He was the other stepfather that a lot of people thought had something to do with it when the first documentary came out. So you're starting, it's getting to the point where a lot of the attorneys are, you know, I see some of these guys on TV now and I'm like, man, he looks really old now, you know? I mean,
yeah.
So it would have to be something, maybe if the new enterprising prosecutor came in. I always thought it was funny, Scott Ellington, you know, the prosecutor in the case that let these guys go, he used to just get blasted because of the way it went down, the Alford plea and all this other business. And I always defended Scott to a degree. I'm like, well, they could have spent the rest of their lives in jail. He let them out. I mean, it may not be the perfect resolution to this, but those guys have been out of prison going on 10 years now. I know. I've talked to Jason. I've talked to Damien. They like not being in prison. So he did help them to a degree.
Yeah. I wonder, but if the impact of this case and what we've learned from, you know, especially lately, not just this case, but many cases, you know, about the justice system and how unreliable it can be and, you know, will this ever happen again, you know, this type of case, do you think, you know, the Satan worshiping and all getting behind an idea that's not really provable?
You know, what's funny to me, I mean, I've been in the courtroom a lot of different states, and it's all kind of a mismatch of the same stuff. And what I'll say is this about that. Our justice system is not about getting justice. It's about who tells the best story once you're in the process.
Yeah.
And I have advocated for this, and I still advocate for it. I think we need a professional juror system in this country. The last group of people that you want if you're accused of some heinous, horrible crime is a group of your peers deciding whether you did it or not. And, you know, my wife's a teacher. I mean, and I think teachers are great. I think plumbers are great. I think people who own businesses are great. They're smart in their own way, all that kind of stuff. But you don't want them going into a courtroom determining, you know, trying to determine what evidence is more powerful than other evidence. I mean, because here's the thing. So in a courtroom, this is how the jury takes their cues. The judge, the prosecutor, and then the defense attorney. So automatically, if you're a defendant, you're at a significant disadvantage, because anytime the judge says, hey, you should take this evidence, you should be more compelling to you than this bit of evidence, and they don't just directly say it. It's kind of like this. So in the West Memphis 3 case, I'll give you an example. There was a sociologist. He's considered one of the top sociologists in the world. And he believed from the beginning, he works at, I believe it, he teaches at Stanford. And he's an expert on false confession. And he immediately went through this whole thing. He thought that Jesse Miss Kelly Jr. gave the worst false confession he had ever seen, among all the false confessions he had written about and studied and testified about in court. And this guy, there is no way he wasn't an expert. Well, in the West Memphis 3 case, he was not designated as an expert. He was able to give testimony, but in a very limited way. And this was all decisions made by the judge. Well, if the judge is making this decision, what is that telling the jury? It's telling them, even on a subconscious level or even a conscious level, you should not put as much gravity to this guy's words. The gravity's less. Now, they had the paper, you know, the guy who got his PhD at a diploma mill in California, who was a supposed occult expert, he was classified as an expert at the trial. So what is the judge telling the jury? You better listen to this guy because he knows what he's talking about.
So, yeah. You know, that's tough. So what do you, you know, how do you qualify a jurist then? You know, like, who decides that? That's kind of a tough one. We can't even get qualified people running for government, right? So,
yeah, I mean, that's absolutely true. You know, I don't know how we would implement a professional juror system, but we need to have jurors who understand the weight of evidence. You know, like I was giving you guys a laundry list of things about Terry Hobbs just a second ago. You know, his DNA is alibi witnesses' DNA being at the scene. Well, I gave you that whole litany of stuff. Well, as a juror, you've got to pick out of all those, which would be the most important. Well, obviously, one thing we're going to do is we're going to say, oh, DNA, that's the most important. Well, here's the funny thing. Of that list I just gave you, the one piece of evidence, the two pieces of evidence that you can make an argument against for sure are the DNA. Because Terry Hobbs, that hair could have gotten onto Michael Moore by secondary hair transfer. David Jacoby's hair could be at the crime scene through secondary hair transfer. These kids and these people are all kind of hanging out. So there's an argument as an attorney. Now, what is the only argument you have against Jacoby and Terry telling two opposite stories? The only thing you can say is one of them's lying. Well, how do you prove that?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, but I think this case, to me, points out policing, law enforcement, and they're only human. And if they have an opinion of someone, like they did of Eccles, so if Terry Hobbs was in the same place or in a place where police didn't like him for whatever the reason, he could have been the one they chose. It's really about feelings and opinions of people more so than evidence. And this is a perfect case that points to that.
Absolutely. Agree 100% wholeheartedly. That, and this is how you know. From the first hours of the bodies being found, they said this, everyone involved, the police officers, you can go back and read the reports, the notes, go look what was in the media, go look, use any litmus test you want to use. They, from the very beginning, said this was a satanic or an occult killing, and they had already identified the type of person that they thought could have committed this crime, not based in evidence, based in personal theory.
Yeah, it's terrible, actually. I think people have to realize that it's not that necessarily that law enforcement are bad people. There's a lot of good people in it, and they want to do good, and they want to solve crimes, but they're just people, and they have the same feelings of you and I.
Yeah, you know, it's something that I always like to do, and I've got lots of friends who are in law enforcement. Some good friends of mine, you know, and they're in law enforcement agencies, you know, pretty much all over the country. But one thing I always like to do is if I've got a case that's just like crazy, like the police are just not, I don't think they're doing a very competent job. I don't, of my own opinion, go out and talk about it. What I will do is I will take that case and I'll go talk to some of my other friends in law enforcement. And almost universally, when I bring them a case that I think is just nuts or they're just off the, they're off their rockers, they're off the wrong path. I've never had a situation where someone from another police agency said, "Hey, George, I think you're wrong." A lot of times they look at me and go, "What are they doing?" And I'm like, "I don't know."
Yeah, that's good. Why did you write that book? Why did you, like, what was the, you know, what was in your mind at the time of actually sitting down and deciding to write a book?
You know, being a journalist, you know, you write pretty much every day or a lot of days out of the month, you know, you spend writing. And so it's kind of like a natural progression that at some point you would want to write a book. One thing I noticed is I was going to a lot of like colleges and high schools and I would talk about this case and it's laborious. Like there's a lot of information. There's a lot of stuff you have to get through. And so I thought to myself, okay, I had all these extensive notes. I had been in the courtroom for all these hours. I'd been on death row. I'd interviewed everybody in the case. I had interviewed the jury foreman. You know, him and I almost got into a fight at the gym one day because he was so mad about some of the stuff I wrote. And so it was just kind of like a natural thing. I'm like, okay, I'm going to write this book. I'm going to concisely put all this stuff in the book, and then everybody will understand, you know, why these guys got released, and they should have got released. I mean, I told Damian Echols when he was sitting on death row to his face, I said, "Damian, I don't know if you did this or not, because that's not my job as a journalist. I wasn't sitting on the ditch bank when the bodies were dumped. Now, as a responsible citizen, I could be a juror in a capital murder case. I could have been a juror in your case. Could I have convicted you in a court of law? Absolutely not." And so that's where I put it. So I wrote the book because I wanted people to understand how this case was laid out and the stuff that, this is the thing. You talked about William Ramsey and some of these other guys who talk about this case. Yeah. They will bring up things that were never brought up in a court of law. And that is where the problem is. We're going back to the fake news and all this other stuff, is they will bring up stuff that was never presented as evidence in court. Well, here's the problem. If I'm making an argument against you and it's almost a dishonest argument. Just let's lay out everything that was laid out in court and then let's come to an opinion. And so that's kind of why I did it. And of course, the last chapter of my book is actually about a totally different case, but it's in the same judicial district as the West Memphis Three. 2 years, almost to the day after these guys got released, there was a guy named Christopher Sal, a 17-year-old who got charged with murdering an 11-year-old girl less than probably 40 miles from where the three boys were found in West Memphis. And he spent 8 months in jail. And at the end of it, they found a sperm cell in her body and they DNA tested it and it didn't belong to him. So, and he had confessed. And his confession had some things that were, you know, you'd read it and you go, "Oh, well, he knew a little bit about it." But then, you know, in retrospect, you really look at it and you sit down and go, okay, if I told someone that a body was found in water and how did they die, what are the chances that a person of average intelligence would say they drowned?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's, so he didn't really know anything. And, you know, the guy whose sperm cell, actually the donor of the sperm cell, he actually had a lengthy criminal history and come home early from work and was another neighbor of this little girl. So, and I think they tried to find a little shoe print inside his Jeep. And if you go back, and he's been convicted of rape, he's never been charged with a murder, but he's in jail for like 30 years now. But the prosecutors believe he did it, you know, wholeheartedly, and they let the other guy go.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy.
Mm-hmm. I tell people, had it not been for one sperm cell, that dude would be on death row right now.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and Eccles, have you talked to him since?
Yeah, I have. I talked to him. Let's see. I've talked to him a few times. I want to say 2017. Yeah. 2017. The state of Arkansas, and you guys might remember this, they were going to execute like 8 people in 2 weeks because their drug cocktail that they used to execute people was about to go out of date.
Yeah.
And so they only ended up executing actually 4 people, but he would have been one of the 8. It would have been if he had still been on death row. Well, I was at the Capitol in Little Rock. They were having a rally to try to stop these executions. And as I'm standing there, I look over underneath a tree next to the steps, and there are thousands of people at this thing, media from all over the world. And I look over and I see Damian Eccles standing there with Johnny Depp. And so I just walk right over to him and start talking to him. And I told him, I said, man, I haven't seen you in a while. And he goes, I don't make it back to Arkansas very much. And so anyway, we sat down, we had a long talk. Of course, as soon as I went over there, within a couple of minutes, a lot of the media, you know, vultures, they just all run over there. And so I saw him then, and then I want to say in August of 2018, maybe, like on the anniversary of their getting out, I contacted him and his wife, and they did a story with me. But I haven't contacted them in probably a couple of years.
Yeah. I just wonder if life can really get back to somewhat normal after such a big event.
You know, Jesse moved right back into the trailer that he was living in the day he got arrested. I mean, at the Lakeshore trailer park there in West Memphis. You know, I always tell people, you know, getting back to his confession, because I think that's really the only thing that anybody can hang their hat on. Yeah. And one thing that they'll hang their hat on is that he confessed multiple times. And I went to Dan Stidham, you know, his original defense attorney, who's a judge now. I went to his office one day out of the blue. I just showed up in Paragould, Arkansas, walked into his office. I said, I want you to explain something to me, Dan. How can he know detail as time went on? He confessed 4 or 5. I don't remember how many times. As he confessed each time, how did he know more details? And Dan just laughed at me. He goes, because he was at trial. He was learning stuff. He learned new things, and then he was able to spout it out. And I was like, okay, well, that makes sense. But I always tell people there's one thing, and they can't get around this one detail in his confessions. He gave one detail in all of those confessions that is absolutely refutable. The detail he gave was that two of the three boys were sodomized. They were not. The state medical examiner admitted during the post-conviction hearings that there's absolutely no evidence that the boys were sexually assaulted in any way. There's none. There's zero evidence. Dr. Richard Suverin, you might know, you remember Dr. Richard Suverin. He was the forensic, and I always say this wrong, I'm going to say it anyway, odontologist who identified Ted Bundy, the serial killer.
Right.
He told me, he testified at a hearing one time, and I said, hey, he said, no, there's no evidence. He said, at all. He said, there's no sperm present. There's no sexually transmitted diseases. There's no anal tearing or bruising at all. And it's really graphic and horrible. But they took the three boys' anuses and they blew them up on these huge pictures and put them in the courtroom. And even to the uneducated, uninitiated eye, you could see that there was no damage to them at all. And Dr. Janice Ophoven, who is she is the preeminent forensic pediatric pathologist in the world. And she said, she's testified in court. She looked at the judge and she said, this is a violation of responsibility. And she was talking to him and everybody else involved in this case, because there was no evidence that the boys had been sexually assaulted at all.
Crazy, crazy case. Now, do you have a website available so people can come and call you names?
You know, I've pretty much just stick to social media now. I was going to start a website back in the day, but the thing about it is the social media is so much more, the reach is just, it's unbelievable. I mean, it's a different animal. I mean, I was reporting at a time and writing at a time before social media. And, you can reach me on Facebook, Instagram, my email address is out there. I mean, people who want to say horrible things to me, they always find me. It's incredible.
Yeah. They've got the time.
Yeah. They do.
I'll tell you, they can get it all at once too. It's great. I love it. Wow. So how's the COVID been for you? Has it affected the way you write, or does it affect any of your creativity?
I don't think so. I started trying to write some, like, I wrote a fiction book that I'm working on right now, and it's decent. Like, I've got a couple of really good friends who are very honest. And if I'm wasting my time, I'm like, hey, if I'm wasting my time, I don't want to waste my time. So I don't think so. It's kind of weird. You know, for a couple of months, I was stuck in my house. My daughter's in college, and so she had to come home from college. And my son actually graduated from college, and he's, you know, he actually got a job in the middle of all this and is making actually doing very well for himself. I don't think so. It's weird, though, because I like being around people. I like going in. I mean, I hate to say it, but I mean, like, I, you know, some of the people I write about, some of those heinous people in the world, I mean, you know, there's an interaction with those people that I kind of miss having, because you want to, you know, somebody asked me one time, like, I wrote about a case where this father and son were convicted of brutally slaughtering a mom, a dad, and a little boy. And they took this little girl and they kept her in a barrel out in a garage. And they only brought her out to rape her and torture her. The case is among the most brutal cases you will ever read about or research. And in fact, I had a woman one time, a producer for a show in California. They wanted to talk about some of these murder cases I had covered. And in this, they asked me for a couple of stories. Well, in the cache of stories I sent them, I sent them this story. And right before we were about to go on, the woman's like, I can't even believe that you can write like this. Because I gave very, very finite details. I mean, it was awful. And so I do, like, and I talked to the two guys who got convicted. I was sitting right next to one of them when he got convicted of quadruple homicide. And so I do miss the courtroom, the interaction with people going out. And, you know, it's, you know, like, I like talking on Zoom call. I'm on a Zoom call almost every day. It's like, you know, but it, I'll tell you this, it's a little bit harder. Like, I was telling you guys, I had discovered that a guy named Polly Litowski, or Polly Lit as he's known in Hollywood, was actually living in the town, working out in the same gym I work out in. I'd seen him 1,000 times. He'd been here a couple of years. Just a nice guy, younger guy, 25-ish. And he's running this huge yarn business, like one of the high-end yarn, like one of the better high-end yarn producing companies in the United States for high-end clothing, you know. And he was just living in New York, had a crazy idea, and wanted easy access to cotton. Well, there's cotton all over the Mississippi Delta, so he just found a huge warehouse where he could set up his machines and start producing this high-end cotton. And so, but yeah.
It's crazy. Crazy. Well, it's been an interesting hour, and I appreciate you taking the time. Our guest has been George Jared, and, of course, the book we're talking about, which is in Memphis, and it's West Memphis 3, Three False Confessions. You can look him up, you know, find him on Facebook, send him some nasty notes.
Yeah, that's what I like.
The more the better, you know, it's keep him alive.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end! By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus,
Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.